today in Honolulu, advocates gathered to talk about domestic violence and standing together as part of the social media campaign, hashtag AfterMeToo. Leslie Morgensteiner was the keynote speaker at this morning's breakfast summit organized by the Domestic Violence Action Summit. Welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, the Me Too campaign was really front and center at last night's Golden Globe Awards. So the timing of this is very interesting for you, I'm sure.
Well, it was amazing to hear Oprah Winfrey and so many other prominent women in the film industry and the TV industry stand together and talk about the fact that things have really changed and that the time's up and everybody is really speaking out. And the most powerful thing you can do to end violence against women, whether it's sexual assault, harassment, or domestic violence, is to break the silence about your own experience and what you see going on. So it was very gratifying, and the timing was good for the Domestic Violence Action Center's media summit this morning.
And so what was interesting to me, the takeaway, the one line that was very powerful was the shift of the power structure. And folks say it's no different for domestic violence or sexual harassment. It's all about power.
Well, it's really true. And for so long, victims of sexual assault, harassment, and domestic violence, we've really struggled to have our voices heard. Women have tried, victims have tried very hard to get our stories out there and to get the media and the criminal justice system to listen. But in large part because of social media and because mainstream media, like public radio, like the New York Times, like the Washington Post, everybody is really starting to cover these women's stories in credible new ways. And I think that it's a lot because women are standing together, but also because we have so many female reporters and women in the media and television and journalism, that this story is getting covered in a way that is not just good for victims, but it's really good for our entire society.
And what can you share with us about your personal experience?
I was a domestic violence victim in my early 20s, my first marriage. I had just graduated from Harvard, and I married a Wall Street investment banker who had also graduated from an Ivy League school, and he had been abused as a child, and he beat me horribly for years of our marriage, held guns to my head. It was a horrific situation that I was, like so many victims, completely unprepared for. And I wrote a book called Crazy Love about it, and then I did a TED Talk to try to explain to people why victims stay. And I didn't, as a child growing up, I didn't expect that I would be a domestic violence victim or a domestic violence advocate, but that's what I have become, and I'm very grateful to be one and to be able to speak out and to join, to be in such wonderful company with other women who are speaking out.
And this summit this morning was not the first time you've come to Hawaii. You have also come to talk to the military here.
Right. I do a lot of military training in Hawaii and other places. The military, fortunately, has a two-hour annual a training requirement to prevent domestic violence and child abuse. And so I speak quite often to large groups of mostly men and some women to break the silence and to get them to be more aware of the ways that they might be vulnerable, either as potential victims or abusers. And it's very powerful and good work. And it's ironic that it takes place in such a beautiful, you know, place that everybody considers to be paradise. But domestic violence happens everywhere. And so it's an important reminder to all of us.
Right. Whether you're in the military, whether you're in the entertainment business or in the visitor industry.
Right. Well, one of the prerequisites for any kind of abuse is isolation. Perpetrators always have to isolate their victim, whether it's a cleaner in a hotel who's isolated in a hotel room, or a young wife on a military base, or somebody like myself who was apparently free on the outside, but my first husband very carefully, physically, financially, and psychologically isolated me from all of my friends and coworkers and relatives. And isolation is a key part of any sort of abuse. And it's another reason why I always encourage people to speak out, because that's the best way that you can break the isolation that you're in.
Now, almost a year ago, we saw the Women's March.
Yes. And I live in Washington, D.C., and so I was part of the Washington, D.C. march, and it was one of the most empowering days of my life. And I think the Me Too movement and the After Me Too movement is all directly related to the Women's March, to the fact that so many women around the world came together and said, no, we are united in this, and there's obviously great strength in numbers. It's actually, strangely, a wonderful time to be a domestic violence advocate, because there's so much good work going on and so many people are bravely coming forward and telling their stories.
And you talked about the power of the media and social media in particular. We should mention that the Women's March was an idea from a woman on Maui.
Well, it's such a wonderful example of how one woman's voice really can change everything. And it's because social media is such a huge amplifier of that. And it's just something to really consider. We're not You know, there's a lot of debate within the community about whether you call yourself a victim or a survivor. And victims are very powerful because now we can speak out and we have social media and we also have mainstream media that's really paying attention. And it's a wonderful thing. And I believe I have two daughters. I have a son, too. And I think that the world is going to be different for them in ways that are very inspirational because so many people have spoken out, because we have these tools to speak out.
And you had mentioned this morning that the focus was media and victims. What can you share about what we're hearing and how maybe parts of the story either get told or don't get told when it comes to the media?
Well, the media has a powerful role to play in educating the public and helping communities to stay safe. Even when the biggest threat is inside our own homes. And when people in the media understand how complicated domestic violence and sexual assault and sexual harassment are, they can cover it in a much more nuanced way. Some of the examples are, you know, one of the things that happens a lot is that perpetrators become invisible and the focus is only on the victim. You have to shine a spotlight on who committed these crimes too, in order for the public to know the history of the abuser themselves. And there other more subtle things are quite often the media and just, you know, in our public discourse, we will say things like she was abused or she was murdered, instead of saying he abused her, this person murdered his wife and child. And subtle things like that actually serve to blame victims instead of holding abusers accountable. And quite often abusers were victims themselves as children. So there's some sympathy to be had for them too. And it doesn't help to demonize abusers, but we have to hold them responsible. And I think that the media plays a very powerful role in reporting the facts, but also reporting the facts in such a way so that we as a society can better understand this problem and solve it.
So what's your projection going forward? You said it's an exciting time to be an advocate.
It is. So many people are speaking out, so that's very empowering to just know that you're not alone and that there's so much strength in numbers. There's a lot that needs to happen, though. And I think that locally the resources of the Domestic Violence Action Center, Parents and Children Together, so many wonderful, great resources. And when we get the word out about the fact that these resources are there for victims, for their families, but also for the media to turn to in times like this when things are happening very quickly and you need somebody to interpret what is a very confusing situation, I think that is very inspirational. I also think that the family court judges need to become much more knowledgeable about domestic violence and other forms of violence against women. There's a lot of – we've come a long way, but there's still a whole lot of work to be done.
All right. Thank you. Leslie Morgensteiner is the author of Crazy Love, a memoir about surviving domestic violence. She came to Hawaii as the guest speaker of the Domestic Violence Action Center's Media Summit on Domestic Violence. Hashtag After Me Too. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, a close-up view of the world of the sex worker. But first, your quiz. All this week on The Conversation, we're looking back at the deadly 7-alarm fire that took place 6 months ago, Marco Polo's high-rise building. So for today's backyard quiz, we're looking at an organization that was central to that event, the Honolulu Fire Department. HFD was established during the days of the monarchy and was the first in the Hawaiian Islands. In its early years, its equipment consisted mostly of buckets and portable water tanks. Soon after its inception, the department added a hand-drawn engine and a hook and ladder company. For a while, the Central Fire Station's Union Street Station was the tallest structure in Honolulu and a local landmark. It was manned by a night watchman who rang the alarm if he spotted a fire anywhere in town. Our backyard quiz question for today, do you know when the HFD was established and who was the man who started it? If you do, call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. If not, we'll come racing to your rescue with the answer in the next half hour.
Hi, I'm Shem Lawler from the Sustainable Transportation Coalition of Hawaii, STITCH. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on HBR's mobile app. Find it in the Apple Store or on Google Play.
People who make their living on the street at night are often the people society would prefer to forget, the prostitutes, pimps, and assorted hustlers you'll find in any city on earth. Whether it's by choice or by force, they live at the fringes, so their story, from their vantage point, is rarely told. Pam Vessels has heard their stories at the source in years of outreach work with the women, men, and transgendered persons working in the sex industry as Waikiki and Chinatown prostitutes. She's speaking at a conference tomorrow aimed at deconstructing sex work and sex trafficking, and she's with us in our studio. Pam, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
What is it that people understand the least about the life of sex workers out on the street?
I think that people in general read about all of the really hellacious things, and they concentrate on that. They concentrate on pimps and hoes and violence. And in reality, only about 10% of sex workers in the United States have pimps. The majority of sex workers consider it work, and they don't have pimps. They have free agency and, as adults, have chosen to be sex workers. And I think that group of sex workers is totally ignored because it's much more interesting to talk about the really negative parts about it.
Well, it's pretty negative when a 16-year-old runaway gets physically abused on the street and coerced into prostitution, isn't it?
I think that prostitution is not something for any child to be involved in. I think that it stops.
So how is that sensationalized? I mean, that's pretty sensational in and of itself, right?
I think that any time a child or an adult is abused, it's horrible and it shouldn't happen. And we should do everything that we can to educate people about that and to help people who are in those situations. But I think that when you look at the statistics across America, that's a very, very small part of sex work. And so we major on the minor, I shouldn't say minor because abuse is abuse and it's horrible, but we major on that one little segment of sex work and forget about the rest of the people who do sex work.
That one little segment has a lot of human suffering in it, doesn't it?
Every time there's abuse, regardless of whether it happens in sex work or if it happens to the wife of an attorney or to a doctor or to a checker at Safeway, is not good and should be addressed.
Well, that's fairly obvious, right?
It is.
So What I'm not understanding is that you seem to be minimizing that percentage, admittedly, by your figures, a small percentage of people who are coerced into sex work, who have a pimp who is, you know, probably getting his or her way through violence.
Not necessarily through violence. I think that's a misnomer.
Psychological coercion. I'm talking about that population of underage prostitutes that you see in any city in America.
You do see it in any city in America. It's usually a small portion. And I've worked with many of these women and have worked with them from the time they started to work, which is very young, until when they're older, out of the life, and have lives as secretaries. Or one woman I know who started work as a child is an electrical engineer. So I think people see it, and they see that women get think that women or children get stuck in that life and they never get out. The reality is there are a lot of wonderful agencies here in Hawaii, like the Youth Outreach Project that works with homeless kids, the Chow Project that works with injection drug users, and the Life Foundation that have outreach workers out on the street working with young people, helping them to make better decisions about their lives, showing them options, giving them opportunities for education and for a different life. And so I do think that it's being addressed. And I certainly don't think that I minimalize the pain. I had a transitional home for 5 years here in Hawaii for sex workers who chose to exit. And so I would not have spent all those years working that hard to help people to get out that chose to get out. Because there are a lot of people who don't choose to get out. A lot of women go into it as adults. I know women who are paid their way through law school as sex workers. I know women who have been trafficked, who then got out of the life and then went back in as independent workers.
Are there women who want to get out of the life who find that it's not that easy?
Yes. I think that it is not an easy process, particularly if you go into the life as a child, because your socialization is different from everyone else's. And you're probably not going to school, and you're not going to the prom, and you're not going through all those phases of life that the general population goes through. So for years, you've been a night person. Everyone else is a day person. You're used to having money in your hand as opposed to the delayed gratification of getting paid every 2 weeks.
You're also used to having sex with strangers. And each earlier before the program when you and I were talking, I postulated a situation in which a young man or woman, prostitute, has a sexual encounter for money. And I suggested that each time that happens, the sex worker is vulnerable to some kind of violence. You responded with an analogy to
war.
The military.
To the military. To our young people joining the military, being sent to boot camp, learning how to kill people, going to foreign countries and killing people and coming home and being given a medal when every day they put their lives in danger. Just like fire people and police
officers.
You're
making that analogy to sex workers.
I'm making that analogy to people involved in dangerous lifestyles.
Well, getting people out of these dangerous lifestyles has been your work, right?
My work has been walking with women and men who do sex work and walking with them non-judgmentally, helping them to make positive decisions in their lives and to do no harm. The conference that's coming up tomorrow at the Ala Moana Hotel is about harm reduction and how to work with people, regardless of the situation that they're in a way that does no harm to them, and helping them to negotiate better things in their lives.
If they're in the life, in the way we've described it, harm would seem to be already being done to them, no?
You know, I think that's a really difficult thing to say. Yes, if they're children, it is harmful, because no child deserves to be out on the street doing sex work. But I also think that people think, well, if you are a sex worker, then you're vulnerable to STIs and HIV. And the reality is that sex workers use protection. It's the young people who go to the clubs and bars and hook up that don't use protection and end up in the STD clinics. Sex workers, it's their job. And so they protect themselves.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Pam Vessels has worked for years with the women, men, and transgendered persons working in the sex industry as Waikiki and Chinatown prostitutes. She's one of the featured speakers at a conference tomorrow called Deconstructing Sex Work and Sex Trafficking. described as a conference addressing these and other current social issues from a harm reduction perspective. It runs all day at the Alamana Hotel, and you can learn more about it on the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, announcing a science symposium for girls in grades 5 to 8, Saturday, February 17th. Registration at sacredhearts.org/symposium.
Joining us for our Civil Beat Reality Check is reporter Anita Hofschneider. She wrote a story about how the city can't seem to spend the federal money set aside for our homeless programs fast enough, and it may fail to meet future deadlines. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So why are we in this situation?
Well, basically, according to HUD, it's just a matter of poor management and poor performance on the city's part. The city administers four funding streams, federal funding streams that are supposed to help housing and homeless and other community development programs. But across the board, the city has failed to spend the money in a timely manner. And so now HUD is slashing how much Honolulu receives.
And that's not good news because our homeless problem is huge.
Exactly. I mean, everyone knows that the homelessness problem here in Honolulu has been growing. It's been persistent. And it's also something that the mayor has said is the top priority for him. But as we can see with these grants, you know, the city is having trouble spending the money. And, you know, this is all money that could help address that problem.
Do we have a handle on whether it's the management of the program, or is it because maybe nonprofits are involved and the city doesn't have control over some of the internal deadlines?
Well, you know, it does come down to management, but nonprofits and their participation is something that the city is looking at changing. For example, one of the changes that they're going to make is that instead of just offering this money to nonprofits through a request for proposal process, they're going to be including it as part of their annual budget analysis and trying to figure out the best way to spend it through some city-sponsored projects. So, if, for example, in one case, Honolulu had nearly $1.5 million from a new housing trust fund, and they put out a request for proposal, and they only got one response, and it was from a nonprofit who didn't have, you know, all the funding that they needed to get the project done in time. So, in this case, they decided to give the money back to the state, who can then give it to another county. And in the future, they will actually be looking at city-sponsored projects to use that kind of money.
That's interesting. So basically go with someone who may not have the capacity to deliver. They basically said maybe Big Island can use it, or Maui or Kauai.
Exactly. And there have been instances in which nonprofits have received money but then had to pay it back through these funding streams because they weren't able to get the projects done in time. So that's something that the city administration says they're taking seriously, and they want to change, and they're taking, you know, proactive steps to address all these concerns that HUD is bringing up.
So when is the next deadline? What do we have to look forward to?
Well, there are actually a few deadlines because there are several different grants. But, for example, for community development block grants, the city has a few more months to shape up on a few projects that HUD indicated were problematic. And there are also a couple grants related to emergency housing for the homeless and people with HIV/AIDS. And for those grants, you know, there's about $100,000 at risk. But HUD is giving the city a couple extra months to spend that money before taking it away. So there's a lot that's being juggled here.
Well, let's hope they meet those deadlines. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Civil Beat reporter Anita Hofschneider with today's reality check.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Haleakala Waldorf School, announcing a high school guided tour at its Kalua Nui campus in Makawao, 10 a.m. to noon this Saturday. WaldorfMaui.org.
January 14th marked 6 months since the deadly blaze at the Marco Polo high-rise in Honolulu. This week on The Conversation, we're taking a look back at the tragedy and a look at what has changed since and what has not. Just last month, crews cleaned off the soot-stained facade, but what's life like now for displaced residents? Tom and Brigitte Schmidt lived on the 26th floor where the fire broke out. Three of their neighbors down the hall died when the flames spread from 2602, where the blaze started. Tom is one of the original owners in Marco Polo, and his wife's a realtor. They don't know when they'll be able to live in their apartment again. The floor is still closed off. But they moved into another unit on another floor with the intention of buying it. But it's been tricky getting financing, as companies are reluctant to commit. The Schmidts join us in the studio this morning.
Well, it's disconcerting being dislocated, and it's paralyzing to be away from your records and, you know, what you need for your daily life. So you're just out trying to assemble things to get back to normal. And 6 months is a long time.
And you folks were able to get into another unit on another floor, but not quite settled in yet.
Well, we got in another unit on another floor, but when we went in there, we didn't have a knife, a spoon, a pillow, a sheet, a towel, or anything. It was just all glazed tile, and the unit was somewhat in disrepair. But, you know, it didn't rain on our head, so we started from there.
So, yeah, this unit was originally on the market before the fire, and I told my client to pull it out from the market because it's, you know, it's a bad market after the fire. Nobody would buy it. And in the real estate, if you've been on the market too long, that means, you know, it indicates that there's something wrong in the building or in your unit. So we pulled it out from the market, and then we started moving in as tenants, and then he agreed to let us in.
Right. And then you folks had hoped to acquire the unit, but financing is pretty tricky right now.
Yeah. So we tried to apply for financing right away, but the lender says that because the common amenities, the common areas, are burned and they are damp from the water and fire damage. So they told us to wait until it's completely repaired. Then they're going to review it again.
Right. And I look back at some of the records. I recall doing stories about how some sales fell out of escrow as a result of the fire. And I believe the last sale was just a few days before the fire.
Yeah, it was 2 days before the fire. Got sold on July 12, and the fire happened on July 14. And after that, there were about 10 properties that were withdrawn immediately from the market. And three of them were previously withdrawn but put back on the market about 4 months ago. And two of them are Tom's Son's listings.
Okay, right. And so we should mention that Tom's Son is a broker with Marco Polo Realty on the first floor, correct?
Yes, Davin has Marco Polo Realty.
And so you own several units in the Marco Polo?
Yes, we have four.
So share with our listeners, you folks live on the same floor and lost some of your neighbors in that fire. You were only recently able to get back there, what, to gather most of your belongings just last month?
I think last week.
It was the second week of December when they told us that we could finally get in, but we have to sign up with the front desk, and then they give us a key.
I'm sure that was very emotional going back to your unit. I know you went in there shortly after the fire, but what was that like for you folks when you walked down that hallway into your unit?
Well, it didn't have a door on the place. It was all covered up with visqueen. And I felt very fortunate because our stuff was largely intact. And all of our neighbors, they had only ash left. They had absolutely nothing. So I feel fortunate. But
it was actually a miracle that all of our stuff are safe from the fire.
I know you mentioned that you had something on the door.
Crucifix,
that,
yeah.
That you think
that
protected.
Was from my husband's mom, who's 92 when we got it from her. And she was 100 last year.
And you put that up on your door?
Yes. So it was partially burned, but I guess it protected our home.
Now, explain to us how many units are on a floor.
So there are 17 units on each floor, and some of them are two bedrooms, some of them are studios, and some of them are one bedroom. And my husband could probably tell you how many are two bedrooms.
There's two studios, three one-bedrooms, and the balance of them are two bedrooms.
But essentially, all of the residents on that floor are displaced.
Oh, yes.
And will be for a very long time.
Yes, and just about the rest of them lost just about everything they had. There was nothing left in their unit. Just their whole unit was ash on the floor. And the appliances were melted down to, you know, two-thirds side. I mean, it was a hot fire.
So you really consider yourselves very lucky.
Very lucky.
You were not in the unit at the time, correct?
We were working. We were out in downtown, and we just received phone calls from friends saying that your building is on fire. And so we rushed into the building right away, and there was traffic on the road. And we were just looking at the 26th floor, and it was our neighbor. And Tom gave him a phone call.
Yeah, he says, "Tommy, your unit's on fire." He says, "Yeah." He says, "I know." I says, "We bought this air conditioner yesterday because our air conditioner was making a lot of noise, and I think it was the air conditioner because when my roommates left the apartment, they checked the kitchen, and there's no fire in the kitchen."
Right, and the person you talked to was one of the tenants in the unit where the fire started.
Yes, it was his unit.
And the fire department, their investigation turned up a cause of undetermined at this point. And
exactly.
I know a lot of the insurance companies are looking to see if they can find out more. But at this point, unofficially, we don't have a cause. But your neighbors said they believe it could have been the air conditioner.
They thought it was the air conditioner.
And I did happen to see on the association newsletter, they were letting folks know, look, it's Christmas time. Everybody's got trees and lights. And everybody was trying to be, I guess, mindful of potential fire-causing situations just because this has happened. You know, it just happened.
Yeah, and we also have several fire alarms drill nowadays. So, yeah, sometimes it goes at 9 o'clock, sometimes at 10 o'clock. And they just let us know that it's a false fire alarm just to make us aware and know where to go.
So how many
in case it really happens?
How
again.
Many drills have you had?
They're really not drills. They're just testing the alarm system. But, you know, I've recommended they do fire drills, but it doesn't seem anything that they want to do.
And you folks have moved into another floor. And shared with me that you might have to vacate that unit for several weeks until they do work in the hallway.
Yes, that's correct.
So we were told that we have to look for a place to go to for about 6 weeks while they are repairing the hallway carpet.
So this is the second time you'll be displaced.
Yeah, and I that's completely unnecessary, you know. People can walk around the people working. They're very insensitive to people's needs or the owner's needs. I mean, these people are the owners who are working for them. They seem to have completely forgotten that they're working for the owners and they want to work at their own pace. This was work that the whole thing should have been done, I would say, in 30 to 45 days. And it's been 6 months. They haven't done any really material work yet except maybe clean up the hallways in the 26th and 27th floors.
So you're pretty frustrated.
Yeah. They should have worked around the clock and got it done so everybody could have gotten back in. I don't understand this kind of behavior.
And we know of people who actually have moved into the building even though the fire triggered several sales to fall out of escrow. Some of the rents are maybe depressed, and so folks are moving into the building to take advantage of the low rent.
That's correct. So maybe about 1 week after the fire, we had a friend whose unit has been vacated by the tenants because they didn't want their little children to smell the asbestos and the lead basement. So they moved out, and there are a bunch of people who are moving in because they're taking advantage of the low rents. So they went down for about maybe $200 to $400 from their regular monthly rent.
So it's an interesting snapshot of where things are in the real estate picture, if you will. I also understand that there is a threshold at which the association has to have, I guess, the buy-in on installing sprinklers in. Can you talk about that, Tom?
Yes, the board of directors asked for a proxy for permission from the constituents in the building, and I think they're within 2% of what they need to get consent to put in the sprinkler system. So everybody seems to want the sprinkler system.
What percentage of buy-in do you have to have?
They have to have, I believe, 65%, and I think they have 63%. So they're almost there. They'll get it, and they will put the sprinkler systems in.
Do you have a better handle on the numbers as to how much it would cost and how extensive that sprinkler system might be?
They said they don't have a plan yet, so that can't be bid yet. But we've asked some companies like Dorvin Lays to go in and put some input into the plan and make a bid. So if we can get 3-4 bids, maybe we can get something competitive we can live with.
And do you support sprinklers in the building?
Yeah, absolutely I do. Society has changed. Nobody knows how to use a sprinkler. Nobody knows how to use a fire extinguisher anymore. Nobody knows how to use a fire hose anymore. So it has to be automatic.
When we
built the building, everybody knew how to operate a fire extinguisher. But that was 40 years ago. Now, they're clueless.
So you're a big supporter of it. And,
yes.
And what about on the bill for mandatory sprinklers?
I voted for it.
All right. Well, thank you, Thomas Schmidt.
Thank
Brigitte,
you.
Thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Anything else you want to
share just on a personal note at all? I mean, tomorrow we're going to be doing a panel on the sprinklers. We've got the fire department in here and from the association, you know, some of the opponents. But anything else?
Yeah, the association, the insurance company, says they're not responsible for the people's relocation. I think they're absolutely responsible for their relocation because the fire was really their negligence. They didn't have fire drills. Nobody knew how to use the equipment. And they allowed people to have, you know, louvered doors open. They were clearly negligent in this matter, so they should be responsible for everybody's relocation cost and their damage. And they're completely disavowing it, which will probably end up in litigation somewhere someday.
We've been talking with Tim and Brigitte Schmidt, residents of Marco Polo, whose home was on the floor where the fire broke out. Tom's a developer. His wife's a realtor. And over the many decades, Tom says he's lived in the building. He has sold and resold more than 500 units in that high rise. Next Sunday marks 6 months since the Marco Polo fire. And tomorrow in the conversation, we'll be talking about fire sprinklers and condominiums with a panel, including the Hawaii Council of Association of Apartment Owners and the Honolulu Fire Department. We'll also be taking your phone calls.
HPR's Legacy Society members are ensuring the vitality of this station far into the future. How? By including HPR in their wills or trusts. While making this valuable contribution, these donors are also taking advantage of federal and state tax laws that may allow reduction of income taxes, lower gift and estate taxes, or provide income during their lifetime. To find out how HPR can be part of your legacy, please call us during office hours. And thanks.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, designer of the Noah Daniel K. Inouye Regional Center, committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design, providing research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our ridiculously small planet and also what we can look for in our dark island skies. As usual, we're turning to the expertise of Christopher Phillips. He's on the line. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What's in store this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. So this week, stargazers look out for Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn in the dawn sky. These are three of the brightest planets and should be easy to spot. The moon this week is waning, bringing with it dark skies towards week's end.
You've got some news about a potential discovery, something that looks like a fossil from somewhere in our solar system.
Yeah, the new year is already bringing with it new discoveries from our faithful robotic emissary to Mars, the Curiosity rover. And it's taking some very intriguing images of what appear to be wriggly tube-like structures located on the surface of Martian rocks. These tube-like structures appear to have similarities to fossilized remains that we find here on the Earth. However, As with all such discoveries, NASA is emphasizing that we shouldn't jump the gun and suggest that we have found evidence of Martian life.
And when you see stuff like this, and I guess this has been the case for decades with images that you bring back from space, you think it's a face, and then it turns out it's a little mountain or something like that. What are some of the explanations for what this thing is that they're seeing?
Well, planetary scientists think that these could have formed as the result of ancient rocks that dissolved and then left behind minerals in shapes that just happen to resemble wiggly worms. They are called concretions, and we find them frequently here on the Earth.
Is there also the case when you have a planet like that, for example, there's some spacecraft that are orbiting it in its atmosphere, you've got the rovers, can stuff ever fall off of there, like little pieces of gear, and it kind of either make an indent in the ground or end up somewhere in, you know, on the ground there in Mars, not where you would expect to find it?
Well, that's highly unlikely, especially when you consider the size of these things. They're only about a millimeter or so in size, and Curiosity had to use a very close-up lens in order to see them. So if they are fossils, they're probably the result of some microscopic action in some form. But they are slightly angular, which leads us to believe that they could, in fact, be mineral formations.
And what would that mean? Some heavy-duty mining exploration is in store for the Red Planet?
I don't think so. Not in the near future.
Well, if you want to take a look at it, we have a photograph of what we've been talking about posted in this week's Stargazer Report online at hawaiipublicradio.org. It's Christopher Phillips. Thanks for the report.
You're welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we ask you to tell us when the Honolulu Fire Department was established and who started it. The year was 1850, and King Kamehameha III was the monarch who signed the ordinance that brought it into being. It grew rapidly in the 1850s under Fire Chief Alexander Cartwright, but Honolulu's firefighters had their work cut out for them from the beginning. Honolulu in those days was a collection of highly flammable structures, and two devastating fires took place in Chinatown, one in 1886 and another in 1900. It was a volunteer company from 1850 until 1893 when the legislature approved salaries for firefighters. And that's our Backyard Quiz for today. Nobody got that. But if you've got one for us, you can send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000. Its 2018 Hawaii Literacy Innovation Conference features Ray McNulty, January 29th through February 1st. Achieve3000.com/community/events.
What if schools taught songwriting? Wouldn't that be great? Young children would learn how to craft songs the same way they learned to write an essay or attack a math problem, and they'd gain a skill that could stay with them forever. Paul Reisler, the founder of a nationwide program called Kid Pan Alley, has done the next best thing. He's created a songwriting residency at schools that has given birth to more than 2,700 songs, with over 50,000 kids taking part. He's coming to Hawaii, and he's on the line with us now. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, or good afternoon, where I am, Chris.
Well, I'm sure it is. What made you come up with this idea?
Well, it was an accident, actually. I live in a very small town in rural Virginia, right along the Skyline Drive, and one of our best friends was organizing a three-week interdisciplinary residency in our local school back in 1999, and she asked me to do music with the kids, and I thought, well, I'm not really interested in teaching them. She'll be coming around the mountain, but I'd been teaching and I've been writing songs since I was about 5 years old, and I'd been teaching songwriting to professional songwriters at that point for about 20 years, mm-hmm. and I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to see what we could do with kids, to see if kids as a group, in a group process, could write a song. And the first day I went in there, we wrote six songs, and by the end of those 3 weeks, we had about 60 songs, and there were a lot of really great ones, so everybody was asking me for recordings of them, and finally I got this idea to get all of the musicians in our community together and record an album.
Were
and
you surprised?
That was the birth of it.
Paul, were you surprised by how many songs those kids had in them that first time?
Yes. I had no idea what to expect. I was just knew that it would be an interesting thing to try, and 2,700 songs later, here we are.
Well, what you found was that a lot more people, and very young people, have songs in them that probably they didn't even know they had in them, yeah?
Well, no, I'm sure they didn't, but, you know, kids have what you really need for songwriting, which is, more than anything, is imagination,
mm-hmm.
and somewhat of a lack of self-consciousness. You can just say whatever comes into your mind before you self-edit it and say that's stupid. And so we have had some totally amazing songs. We've even had a song that got a Grammy nomination.
That self-editing is one of the things that happens when we grow up, and I use grow up in quotation marks. But we do, as we get older, we talk ourselves out of a lot of creative endeavors, I think.
That's exactly right.
So
I noticed that kids are, there's a little bit of an inverse relationship between the quality of the songs and the age of the kids after about fifth grade, where they start being so self-conscious that they have to edit themselves before they say anything.
That's when the second guessing of begins. Is that a good idea? Could it have been a better idea? All those little demons right. we have that kind of drag us down in a way.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Paul, here's a song that was crafted by some Hawaii kids. I'll let you, we'll play a little bit segment of it, and I'll let you tell me about it.
Okay.
The shells on the shoreline, the mountain breeze, the stories of our ancestors swaying palm trees. It's perfect here in paradise, perfect on the Aina. Let me tell you who I am. I am who I am.
Who was that, Paul?
That was John Chiave. Mm-hmm. Singing and playing one of the guitars, and I was playing the other one. We were both playing slack key style.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a song we wrote with kids at North Kohala Elementary on the Big Island. They were third graders there, and I just love the song because it really captures the mood for me of being there on the islands.
How does
I've really noticed that. Go ahead.
How did it come to you? I mean, did you know one kid suggest one line and then another got added? Was it sort of lyrics first or chord changes first? What was the, you know, what were the building blocks here?
So when I walk into a classroom, usually I say, "Well, what do you want to write about today?" And we get about 20 ideas up on the board, and then they vote on it, and whatever gets the most votes is what we write about. And someone said, oh, let's write about being Hawaiian. And then we do lyrics first. And the reason we do lyrics, well, we don't do a whole song. We do a section of lyric first. And so we'll brainstorm, and then we'll start, when I start to see some direction taking shape from the brainstorming, we'll start to write a section of lyric. And the reason we do lyric first is I want the kids to say exactly what they mean,
mm-hmm.
not to worry about, oh, can I fit it into this box of chord changes? And so a lot of the Kid Pan Alley songs may have a couple extra beats here and there because they're saying exactly what they mean. And then mm-hmm. after we have a section of lyric, we clap. I have them read the lyric, and we clap the first line to get the rhythm, the natural rhythm of it. And then I'll have another child read it. And with my hand, I'll show them the pitch they're speaking on. Because in popular music, it's informed by the way in which we speak. In a way, you could think of speech as being compressed melody or compressed song, and song being expanded melody. We go up higher, we might go down a little lower, but still it needs to follow the natural pitch and rhythm of our conversation. And we'll just go through, someone will come up with the first line musically, and I'll play it for them in three or four different styles, maybe as a blues, maybe as a song like this, Hawaiian, and maybe as a jazz song, and they'll pick which one most evokes what they're trying to say. And we just go through it line by line and do that until we have a section completed.
You know, Paul, a songwriter I worked with, a very good songwriter I worked with a long time ago, told me that he knew he had a song when he could sing it, clap his hands, and with no accompaniment, that it would work in that context. Just melody, hand claps to give you the beat. It sounds like something like that happened in your process.
Absolutely. I think songs should be able to stand alone. And so a great song can be sung a cappella. It doesn't end. It's always wonderful, you know, to add all the other instruments and have all of that, but so much of the time there isn't much there in a song, and so they dress it up and put a lot of icing on the cake to try and make it look like something. And I really believe that the song, the melody and the lyrics should be able to stand on their own and really speak to what you're trying to say without needing all that other stuff piled on top.
Couldn't agree more, Paul. Thanks very much for talking with us. Paul Reisler is the founder of Kid Pan Alley, a nonprofit that provides group songwriting residency programs to children in schools across the United States. Kid Pan Alley is coming back to Hawaii beginning on the 13th until February 10th. And Paul will be at Pu'ukukui in Wailuku, Maui, at Kihei Elementary, and at Kamaili Academy in Waianae during that period. You can learn more about Kid Pan Alley on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
Best friends, they're always by your side. Don't you worry. Best friends, they stand the test of time. They cheer you on. Best friends. Best friends, they stand the test of time, they cheer you on. Best friends.
We have to go, but up tomorrow we continue the conversation about fire sprinklers in condominiums with the panel and your questions.
And we'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave your comments at 808-792-8217. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation.
If you missed any of our shows or want to find a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Look under our talk shows for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.